Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. 30 years ago, which is hard to believe, NWA released Straight Outta Compton. And 3 years ago, the movie Straight Outta Compton came out, and I did a cover story for Rolling Stone. Dr. Dre and Ice Cube were on the cover, and I talked to all of the living members of NWA about the movie, but also really about their early years and how that debut album came together and what it meant. And I thought, since we're just past the 30th anniversary of that album, that we'd play some of my interview with Ice Cube, who went into a lot of detail about what it was like in those early days. At the beginning of this interview that I'm about to play, which again was we did in LA 3 years ago, Ice Cube talks about why Straight Outta Compton is still relevant today, still relevant 3 years ago, and I would say still relevant now. So let's hear that.
But it's a Sign of the Times movie too, you know. It has to put the people back into the 80s, into the 90s, see why we did the music, you know, not just, you know, we some young, angry, you know, niggas out of South Central, but why do we make them kind of records is the question.
Right.
And that I hope we answer somewhat in the movie.
The first answer for people who completely didn't understand was probably, you know, Rodney King and the LA riots. Mm-hmm. Past couple years, people started to become aware again that it's like there's a Rodney King every day.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, you know, it's incredible. What's sad is that the Fuck the Police record was, I say, 400 years late. To know that it's been a constant. There's been 1,000 Rodney Kings every year that we don't hear about. And just now with technology, we able to really see,
right,
these pockets of bullshit that, you know, poor people have been dealing with forever. You know what I mean? So what's good is that what's done in the dark comes to light. And what's bad is that the shit is even done in the dark. You know, that's kind of what's still, you know, terrible about the situation, and still what makes our movie relevant today, you know, and makes NWA relevant today.
So growing up, is it true that Dre was just a couple houses down? Is that like, yeah, that close? So did you know him even as little kids or like?
No, he moved over there after he had did his first record.
That's right.
Dr. Dre and Surgery, like 84,
right,
85, right. He moved over here. And, you know, we just started hanging. And
Sir Jinx connected you?
Yeah, Sir Jinx is, he was one of my homeboys that we hung out, you know. Sir Jinx actually, you know, showed me a lot about hip-hop. You know, hip-hop was new.
Yeah.
Jinx was, like, advanced. You know, he was, he had turntables, he was scratching, he was breakdancing, you know, he had cardboard and shit everywhere. You know what I'm saying? He just was a b-boy before all of us. We were still in the Lakers and the Raiders and girls and shit. You know, we weren't really into hip-hop. And he started dibbling and dabbling. We'd hear his beats coming out of his house and shit, and I would be interested. So I would go start hanging with Jinx a little more and start rapping. He helped me rap on beat. You know, yeah, what I mean? I used to rap, but I didn't have a beat, so I just rap all over the place. So
yeah,
like, nah, you gotta catch this beat right here, and you gotta be on time. And so, you know, we worked it, and we had a group together, a stereo crew. And we was always waiting for Dre to pop over and show him what we got. And then Dre ended up moving with Jinx. And so I saw him all the time, so we was able to really develop a cool relationship. And, you know, he was moonlighting. He was doing records for other people on the side, beats and shit. And I would help him write hooks, write little shit. And then I started helping him write songs for the record crew. And one of the songs I wrote became a local hit.
Is that Cabbage Patch?
Cabbage Patch.
Yeah.
It became like a local hit. So he really had confidence in me then. So started doing these neighborhood mixtapes, talking about the neighborhood, and you know, it was really like the beginning of our style. And shit started catching on, and then Eazy-E got a hold of one of those tapes and kind of hunted Dre down and made that connection. So that's kind of how
the style of, like, I listen to you know, you listen to CIA songs like My Posse. It's like, it's like Run DMC and a little like Beastie Boys, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was big. We was big fans of License to Ill, big fans of Run DMC at the time when we did that record. So Dre had us fucking in there, damn near emulating that style, you know. But it was cool. It just wasn't the shit. The records we was doing for the mixtapes were the shit. Mm. Like street records, talking about the neighborhood and what's going on.
Were there sort of what you might have called reality rap songs you were doing before Boys in the Hood? That was not really the first one in that style? Or
yeah, it was reality raps, you know, before Boys in the Hood. These are all just, you know, 16 bars at the beginning of a mixtape. It's real quick shit, nothing long. But, you know, we can say what we want to say, and we can, you know, we knew they weren't going to be sold nowhere but in the neighborhood, so it was more, I guess, it just made more sense to bring our thinking down to a neighborhood level instead of thinking that we're going to be the Beastie Boys and shit.
Right.
You know, on a world tour with Mr. Malcolm McLaren and shit. You know what I mean? It's like, we didn't have no fucking thoughts of grandeur like that. It just was like, this shit gonna be hood shit. Let's talk about hood shit. And then that became our signature style.
What did you hear that was doing that kind of thing? This at 6 a.m, right? That was a
6 a.m. This is even a little before 6 a.m. I think the first thing we heard was PSK, Schoolie D, Chest Ice. They had this dirty ass rap called Latoya. I mean, it was like the nasty version of Lottie Dottie. And Blowfly had Rap Dirty, you know, so it was just like these fringe raps that were X-rated.
So it's as much the dirty part as the street reality part, right?
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, the thing is hip-hop, you know, before it was all about talking about horror shit, it was like, how clever are you? How damn near funny you can be. You know what I mean? How entertaining can you be with a rap? So, you know, to rap, you know, people like Blowfly and shit like that was, they had the style to me down pat. He was talking dirty and cussing, he was rhyming, but he was talking about some fly shit.
Right.
That pertained to him. So, to me, that style was just, it was raw, but it was perfect. For him, you know.
And some of the stuff you were doing live, right? Like, you had a thing. Did you have a thing called Diane? That was like Russia.
Yeah. We was gonna do a show, and Dre was like, "Man, y'all have to be clever, because just getting up there rapping, nobody wanna hear that shit. Y'all gotta do something that's entertaining and clever." So what we did was take Roxanne, and flipped it into this dirty rap called Diane. Shit.
Do you remember her name?
Yo, Kate. Yo, what's up, man? They got that bitch they call Diane. Damn, I don't know. It was just, we took their whole rap and flipped it,
yeah.
And the crowd went crazy. And, you know, all these things were helping us figure out what we needed to do. And then Eazy just was like, I want to do those kind of records. I mean, I want to do records, but I want them to be hard and dirty. I don't want to do the clean shit y'all trying to get played on the radio.
Yeah. What was your first impression of Eazy?
Little hustler.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, a little hustler, like a little dope dealer. Just feeler, track shoot. You know, this shit was just all fresh and clean. Little jewelry on. Just tell somebody.
Did you like him at first class?
Mm-hmm. I admired him, you know, he was shit. making money in the neighborhood. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
He had money. He had his clientele. He was doing this shit. Didn't ask nobody for shit. So, yeah. I dug him.
He came to Dre, as far as you know, and said, I want to do a label. Or maybe start out with a record store, or is this more of a Dre? I'm curious what your version of the...
All I know is, like, him and Dre was powwowing a lot. Yeah. And, you know, he just was like, yeah, I'm going to start Ruthless Records. You know, so I probably had to talk to Dre on really what turned him on to do that. But, you know, Dre was like, all right. And he had this group that he was going to put on Easy's label called HBO.
Right.
And he told me to write something for him. Yeah, he didn't tell HBO what I was writing for him.
So. Were you sitting in English class in high school writing that? That's the kind of legend, yeah?
Yeah, I was in a lot of classes writing that shit.
Like scribbling in a notebook while you were not paying attention.
I was writing rhymes, you know what I mean, while shit was going on, you know. It was more interesting than the English I was learning.
Listen to that now, and still, like, a really impressive piece of work. Like, there's so much going on in that, so much vivid imagery, so much life in it. Like, how much of that was, you know, the details were made up, or how much of it was stuff you'd observed, or how much, like, what we were...
It was all, to me, neighborhood shit that we all seen, heard, or went through growing up. You know, it's like, it was just accumulation of all kind of crazy shit that we kind of grew up privy to and just put in the line.
It was like, I mean, to a certain extent, there was a certain fantasy, because you weren't that gangster. You were a kid who hadn't been involved in anything like a lot of that stuff.
Well, you know, it's like, it's hard to grow up in South Central and be completely clean of anything.
Yeah.
So it don't matter what age you are, all that shit is affecting you, all that shit is coming right to your doorstep. You know, so you can't get out the way. You know, it's like you either embrace it or get ran over by it. So our way to embrace it not only was Dylan, but was to make music too. You know, it's just hard to explain how, you know, you just can't be from the neighborhoods and just come out squeaky clean. It just don't happen.
I've heard you say that you had a father and an older brother, mm-hmm. and so there was a lot of stability to kind of keep you.
Yeah, it was like more shit to deal with than gangbangers. You know what I mean? It was like you dealt with gangbangers in the street, but you know, I was gonna have to deal with my pops 24/7. I was gonna have to deal with my brother 24/7. So fortunately, I just started doing positive shit before I really got caught up. You know, it was like the music, doing hip hop, playing sports, basketball, football. You know, I stayed doing shit.
How aware were your parents of like this beginning of your hip hop career while you were in high school? Like, how about
it was it?
What did they think of it?
They asked me why did I have to cuss so much.
How realistic was that? Did you feel that the scene of recording? Were you actually thrown out of the studio to stop laughing at Easy with all that?
It got to a point where, you know, they was in there so long, it was just like, it was better for us to leave. You know, it got abbreviated for the movie, but it got to a point where it was just better. So Drake could just focus on Easy. Easy wasn't worried about us. He wasn't worried about how he sounded. If the shit came out stupid, nobody would ever know.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, it was just all done to make him comfortable.
You created Eazy-E the rapper in that moment, you know, and then you created someone whose solo album came out way before you got to do one and all that. That was a weird feature of the thing, right, is that Eazy Does It came out like 3 months, I think, before Straight Outta Compton. Did you, at the time, did that start to ring alarm bells for you, or was that...
It was dope, you know, it was like he was the star that we, you know, all created, so to speak. And, you know, he was blowing up. And You know, with NWA, he was actually spreading the love. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I'm blowing up. Now, if I'm blowing up and then I'm part of this crew, then the crew gonna blow up with me. So it was just, that's how it happened. We was just happy somebody out the damn crew was blowing up.
Right.
And that we wasn't gonna be just stuck as locals.
Like, how much of his rhymes were you writing?
At the beginning, mostly all of them. You know, and then as the albums start coming, you know, Ren started writing some, and then DOC. So it was between us three.
And did you have, like, a character in mind for him? Because you definitely wrote differently for him than you would write for yourself, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of had his own persona that was, you know, people used to think he was 15 for a long time, you know, so it's like, he was damn near like a, not really like a cartoon image, but you could do anything, you know, from, I mean, we had a Gumby fucking line. He was one set that from around the
right.
So it was like, that easy name was just like something you can play with, fuck with, you know. Remind me of Bootsy or somebody. It was like,
that's a good comparison. I like that.
You know, it was just that name where you could do anything with it. You know, he could have been action figure or whatever he wanted to do with that.
Right.
You know, it was the perfect persona to play with. You know, it was bad, but it was vivid. You know, like a Chucky doll or something. It's just like, you know, just this fucking thing that's, you know, got a life of its own.
At some point, though, you split and, like, went to college for a while.
Yeah. You know, I just, West Coast hip-hop at the time was just so in its infancy. We never knew it was going to come off the launching pad. We never knew it was going to blow. So I wanted to have something to fall back on. Going to a technical trade school was the best thing to do.
And then you came back, and then, like, what was the situation with the records at that point? Like, what? Because
shit was blowing up. Yeah, you know, everybody was doing shows. We had, you know, setting up tours and all kind of stuff. So it was in full swing when I got back.
It was actually after you'd already recorded Shredder Compton at that point, or no? No, you recorded.
I got back.
You recorded NWA and the Posse. You recorded, and then,
yeah, NWA and the Posse wasn't really an album. It was just all of our singles they put together.
Right. Got it.
And some of our guys that we was associated with. So that was never really a sanctioned NWA album. It was more of a record company's compilation. Mm-hmm. You know, so the album when I got back, they were starting to work on Easy Does It.
Right.
And from there, we went from Easy Does It straight to Straight Outta Compton.
Your high school, were you bused into, like, a white neighborhood?
Yeah, I was bused into the San Fernando Valley.
Uh-huh.
So, like, 30 miles or something.
It was a 30-mile bus ride?
Some shit like that, 25, 30
miles. Damn. Every day?
Every day.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was.
That's really far. So, and not, I mean, far geographically and also far culturally, right?
Yeah.
What did you take away from seeing that?
That, damn, we really are poor. I was doing pretty good. We really don't have shit in our neighborhoods. It was like going to the Brady Bunch every day, to be honest. Like, you know, going to the Partridge Family. It's like jumping in a bus full of black kids from the hood into these white schools. A little culture shock, but, you know, after a while, you was able to deal.
Once you used the word injustice to talk about what you saw.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just the haves and the have-nots. Everything's better, from books to classrooms to facilities to teachers. It's like everything was better out there than going there to Washington, my local school. I don't think I would have had a perspective I have on things if I just went to the school in the hood. I wouldn't be as worldly in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Just knowing. I think that's what helped me be able to deal with Jerry Heller.
Uh-huh.
There's no intimidation factor at all. You look like one of my bullshit history teachers and shit.
I wonder if it also did it also help you maybe to be suspicious of him from the start?
Yeah. Well, you know, it made me know how to deal with white people. You know what I'm saying? In the hood, you don't come across them, you don't know how to deal with them. You know, we pretty much all the same. It's not right is right, wrong is wrong. Real shit is real shit, and bullshit is bullshit. You know?
Your sort of actual experience with police harassment.
Mm-hmm.
When, how consistent was that? How old were you when it started?
It's just, I don't know nobody from the hood who ain't really been fucked with by the police at some point. And when you're in the hood, they get you early. They get you, they start fucking with you when you're 9, 10. Just to put that intimidation in you. You know, just to start intimidating you at an early age and make sure they fuck with you. Even if you, whether you did nothing or not, it's just like, we gotta make sure we're imprinting our fucking stamp on these young dudes that we might have to deal with when they get a little older. So, you know, they start at an early age fucking with you, pulling you off your bike, making you put your hands on the hood. You'd be sitting, fucking 9, 10-year-olds sitting on the grass, just play football. The motherfucker swoop up and fuck with you. You know what I mean? Until you either get out the neighborhood or, you know, whatever you do. But it's just, as a teenager, it just happened all the fucking time. All the time. Even recording the records, we just get fucked with. The torrents.
Just like in the movie, isn't it?
Just like in the movie.
Yeah.
Just fucking with you. You know, fucking with you if you bad, fucking with you if you good, it don't matter. Systematic, you know, it's like, make sure you fucking put a good imprint. You know what I mean? On these young ones, so they know to fucking be scared of you when they get older. And this fear turns into resentment, frustration, and hatred.
Fuck the police itself. By one account, you had maybe the chorus or a little bit of it, and Dre at first wasn't necessarily into it at first. Is that, do you remember?
Yeah. Well, Dre was, he had to go and do weekends in the county. So he didn't want them, he was like, man, we ain't about to do this song. I got to go to the county every fucking weekend. And, I'm not about to give these motherfuckers no extra room to fuck me up. In jail.
Right.
So he didn't want to do it at that time until he got, until he, you know, I guess got off of that weekend furlough, whatever the fucking shit is, weekend something.
Mm.
You gotta go to jail every Friday, get out every Monday. It's like weekend jail. So while he was doing that, he didn't want to have nothing to do with the song, but, you know, months later, when I brought it back up, wasn't under that condition or whatever, so he was with it.
Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad because I'm brown and not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority.
You couldn't have predicted that the FBI was going to write you a letter, but in some sense, you must have known this would, it would stir up some shit in some way or another.
I remember recording a song and ran. Looked at me and said, out of all our songs, this one right here gonna start some shit. So it's like we had a sense. That's what we wanted to do. Or it's like, why do it?
Right.
If the song ain't gonna make the police mad, why the fuck do it?
Call it Straight Outta Compton to make that such a big part of your identity and the songs. Like, what was the thought behind that?
I mean, at the time, everybody was calling out their hoods. If you was from a borough, you know, it was Brooklyn's in the house.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Bronx, yeah. Be down Bronx, money making Manhattan. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, uptown. Everybody was talking shit about where they from.
But it's all New York.
It's all New York.
Yeah, that's,
and that's what,
yeah.
Easy's whole thing is, we got to put Compton on the map.
Right.
You know, that was this whole fucking thing that even people in L.A. was embarrassed to say they was from Compton. Mm. Compton was just like, yo, the worst of the worst.
Uh-huh.
So Easy was like, man, I'm going to be proud of Compton. So he wanted to put Compton on the map. day one. He was like, man, motherfuckers yelling all that Brooklyn shit all the time. Motherfuckers yelling the Bronx. Motherfuckers is yelling out they hoods. Let's yell out Compton. So
there's also a sense that West Coast hip hop in general needed to be established much more strongly, right?
Yeah, you know, Ice-T had done a lot to bridge the gap, but it was still, you know, still a lot of work needed to be done. Somebody else needed to solidify what he was doing a little bit, a whole nother group with a whole nother flavor that had music that was, you know, worldwide. You know, it was a sense of pride, but not to where we was saying what we doing is better, or we was just, it was more like, look at us too. You know, we wanted to be accepted into the hip-hop nation.
There's a sense that, so once the record came out and you started to become popular, that you, on some level, when you see it in the movie when you have all the guns in the hotel, that you started to a certain extent, not you personally, but just this group, like, starting to live out the lyrics a little more. You bought a bunch of guns, like, which Jerry supposedly he expensed it as stage props or something, like, mm-hmm. like, and that maybe somehow almost like the lyrics were coming to life. Is that accurate?
I think, you know, it's like, not really. You know, the lyrics didn't have to come to life, because we all felt like we living in the middle of this shit. You know, it ain't nowhere to escape. So we are in the middle of dope dealing, gang banging, police brutality, fucking Reaganomics, just everything. We was to us stuck in the middle of that shit, and so we was just doing what we would naturally be doing if we wasn't making music. You see what I mean?
Right.
We'd just be out there trying to survive.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So
you just happen to be doing it.
You know? Yeah. It's
yeah.
like, if we had the money to buy guns, we would have bought guns, whether we was making music or not.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
It's like, I bought my first shotgun when I was 17 years old just because I had enough money. I was able to go do it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it was like, we was just able to get the thing that we wanted to get anyway. We just had the money to do it now. You know, so Eric had all kind of guns, but when he got money, he got bigger guns. You see what I mean? He just
right.
got big, outrageous shit.
Yeah.
Just because we had the money, you know? So we didn't realize that we were actually something special until we went on tour. And then we started to see, oh, shit. We actually becoming a fucking musical group.
Right, for real,
and
yeah.
And just locals getting together, doing some shit, and then going back and doing what we usually do until it's time to come back again, you know. So we was like, oh, we actually a group.
Right. For that
and
moment.
For that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it all fucking unraveled. It's like, as soon as we realized it, it all started to come apart.
It was actually on that, in the movie, it's sort of like as the tour is ending, that you left, but it was actually sort of during that tour, right, that it became clear that you weren't going to be able to continue.
Yeah. It's like late. It was like still late during the tour. Realized the shit was, still didn't realize it was going to be super funky until we was off tour. I still thought it was going to get rectified.
And there's also the business of your solo album and when it would come out and all that, right?
That wasn't even the
yeah.
question.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't like, man, where's my shit? It was like, I knew I was in line.
Right.
I was just waiting my time. You know, it was like, we was already on a wave. This big NWA wave. I didn't need to add a solo record to that. You know, a lot of people were like, well, he left because he wasn't, his solo album didn't come up fast enough. I wouldn't have cared if we did another NWA record and then a solo record.
So
it wasn't really about that at all.
Yeah, a lot of people do think that. So it was more purely about the just the feeling that you were not, quite simply, weren't getting paid what you should have.
Yeah, you know, it was the real discrepancy was they wanted to treat the Eazy-E album and the Straight Outta Compton album as separate entities. Meaning, Easy would just get paid off the Easy album, And then we would all get paid off the NWA album, including Easy. And I was like, wait a minute. We put just as much work into the Easy album as we did with NWA.
Right.
We should all split both records. And they just thought out that was the craziest concept in the world. And I just was like, y'all act like Easy did this record by himself.
Right.
That is an NWA record. It just has one artist on it. So they didn't want to see it my way.
Jerry and you guys never did not get along, but it was also Eric, right? I mean, like, he...
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm pretty... It's like, Eric didn't know the business. He was learning the business as he was going along. So I think he would have did whatever Jerry advised him to do. And I just think Jerry was like, I don't need to do that. Just work it out. Here's how you should get paid. And he just ran with that instead of actually working it out.
Heller has actually blamed Brian Turner for encouraging you to leave.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Brian Turner was trying to discourage me from leaving. He's like, man, you sure? Why you want to leave? Why you want to leave? I'm like, dude, it just ain't working.
Yeah.
This motherfucker Jerry is a fucking liar.
Yeah.
He's a liar. You know, just try some shit that didn't work and got caught. And instead of paying me, they'd rather kick me out so I don't have to pay everybody else. If they hear Cube got paid, everybody be like, what about me? What about me? What about me? So... it's easier to get rid of that problem instead of paying all five guys or four guys. So it was, to me, like, they just thought that it wouldn't matter.
There's some weird elements to the split, or what I was going to say is, like, for all of the intense battle raps and stuff, like, you had lunch with Dre, like, right when, after you recorded No Vaseline, right before it came out. So it's like this weird thing where never... on a personal level, seemed to get as hostile as people might imagine from the record. I mean, how do you see that?
Well, you know, it was like, if you listen to America's Most Wanted, it's nothing said about NWA. That's right after the breakup. So I wasn't even going to go there with them on record at all.
Right.
To me, it was like, it was a business decision you guys made wrong, but whatever. And I was moving on. And then I'm hearing all these disses. Yeah. To me, so I'm like, I gotta retaliate. I didn't really have venom for nobody really but Jerry Heller and Easy for letting Jerry Heller dictate so much shit. But Dre and Ren and Yella, you know, it's kind of like, I only dissed them because they dissed me on
right.
record. You
right.
know what I'm saying? And if they wouldn't have went there with me, I would have never dissed them.
The niggas with attitudes, who you fooling? Y'all niggas just phony. I put that on my mama and my dead homies. Yellow boys on your team, so you're losing. Hey, yo, Dre, stick to producing. Calling me on a butt, you Benedict. Easy E saw your ass and went in it quick.
You got you know, in retrospect, you obviously would have saved yourself a lot of shit if you not put in a few lines of No Vaseline about Jerry, but...
Yeah.
I like when the movie said people don't even know what anti-Semitic means. It's
I didn't know what it meant until.
Is that true?
No, I didn't. Motherfuckers started coming after me and was like, yo, you can't say that. And I'm like, well, why not? Because, you know, and I got to explain why it was just not cool to lump Jerry, you know, with anybody cool. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if we want to diss Jerry, just diss Jerry off by itself. You shouldn't have brought that into it.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. But it doesn't mean that I'm anti-Semitic. Like, right. I was like, yo, I'm ready to, I want to hurt, you know what I mean? The whole Jewish race and all this bullshit. It's like, I just don't like that motherfucker. And y'all shouldn't like him either. But, you know, I understood. You know, it was a lesson learned. But it was still just a battle rap, to be honest. It was just a diss. It wasn't like, with all of them, it was just a battle rap.
From what I understand, it is true that before Easy passed away, you guys really were talking about doing one more record. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw him at the tunnel in New York months before he died. And it's a trip because it was like old times, you know. It's like we was all past apologies, all past, yo, you know, feeling funny. It was just like old times. We was just sitting there fucking talking about people, you know. Like, look what he got, look what the fuck she got, you know. Just clowning, having fun, just how we usually were. It was the first time we was back to normal, you know, back to how it was in 89.
Yeah.
And we hadn't had a lot of face-to-face conversations, but this one was like, I really thought we was really mending what had broke.
Pretty sad, man.
It is, man, because I had so much hope. You know, when you're getting into it with somebody and it's over,
right,
there's a sense of relief of, you know what, that shit is over.
Right.
You can turn the page on that. So it was that sense of relief that, you know, whenever you can get a beef off your shoulder, it always feels good. It always takes the weight off. So, you know, I was optimistic. But I knew him and Dre were just in the thick of their issues. But he was like, he was confident that, you know, that he don't have Jerry Heller with him no more, and that he can work it out with Dre. You know, Dre was always like the best as far as what he wanted to do.
Right.
You know what I mean? As far as like when he was DJing, he was one of the best DJs in the world.
Right.
Scratches was cleaner. His blends were effortless. You know what I mean? It was just like, it looked like he did things effortless. That sound is so great. And that he always had that magic, you know, when it comes to music. And, you know, I always felt that I was in good hands. You know what I mean? I always felt like in working with Dre, he gonna make sure his sound is good as it can sound.
Right.
Even when he sets up speakers in the club when he was DJing.
Right. That's interesting.
Like where he put them, how he EQ'd them, you know, it just sounded bigger and better than everybody else party. So, you know, he just has that in him. You know, when he started doing beats and making mixtapes, his was sounding better than everybody else. You know, it was one person who I think was able to compete with him for a while, but then even he couldn't sustain it. And it was this other guy named Egyptian Lover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who was big. You know, he was, at the time when I first met Dre, Egyptian Lover was a bigger DJ. Egyptian Lover did better records, you know.
Dre surpassed him.
Yeah, quickly. Like a few years.
So that was Ice Cube talking about the early days of NWA and his early days. And again, that was for a cover story I did for Rolling Stone in 2015 about the movie. And it's funny that Cube was saying that about Dre's engineering skill, because the technical aspect is what Jimmy Iovine first noticed in Dre's records and led him towards him, because Jimmy Iovine was also obviously an engineer. And reporting that story was a wild ride. One of the things that happened is the late Jerry Heller, who was, of course, NWA's original manager and doesn't come off super well in the movie, called me in what was an off-the-record call. He's since passed away. And just like harangued me for an hour about everything that was wrong supposedly with the movie and everything that they're ungrateful for and everything. And it was too bad it was off the record, but it was wild. He then proceeded to sue everyone in sight over the movie, and then passed away. And I'm not actually sure whether the lawsuit like continued after posthumously. We'll have to look that up. Anyway, this has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now. For the 30th anniversary of Straight Outta Compton. How are these albums 30 years old? How is that possible? We'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are a podcast. download us as a podcast, subscribe to us as a podcast, maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes. And as always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.